Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Poland says it is negotiating with the United States to permanently station American military heavy weapons inside its borders. As part of a U.S. plan under consideration to bolster its presence in Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, and further deter Russian aggression. The Polish Defense Ministry says the proposal calls for the U.S. to deploy battle tanks into their equipment in Poland. It was discussed in Washington last month, and the Defense Ministry expects a decision soon. If approved, the U.S. would store fighting vehicles and position as many as 5,000 troops in Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Poland, and possibly Hungary, all countries once part of the Soviet bloc. British media are reporting that London has pulled spies from hostile countries after Russia and China decrypted top-secret files leaked 2 years ago by former U.S. national security contractor Edward Snowden. The BBC and Sunday Times are reporting the pullback was ordered after Moscow gained access to more than 1 million encoded files. The newspaper, quoting separate government forces, said China also accessed the documents, which are said to reveal a wide array of Western intelligence techniques. Iran's president is warning world powers negotiating a final nuclear agreement to stop complaining over issues or risk missing the June 30th deadline for an agreement. Speaking to reporters in Tehran on Saturday, President Hassan Rouhani said an agreement is still within reach, but some issues remain. Iran continues to balk on a key issue for U.S. and European allies, allowing inspections of its nuclear facilities, which Tehran contends could compromise state secrets. World powers, the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have been seeking an agreement about Iran's nuclear development program in exchange for limiting future nuclear development. Iran expects international sanctions to be lifted. This is VOA News. Activists say Kurdish fighters have made advances toward an Islamic State stronghold in Syria near the Turkish border amid intense fighting between the two sides. The fighting has forced thousands of residents to flee to Turkey. Hundreds of Syrian refugees gathered near the Turkish border yesterday in an attempt to escape the violence. Meantime, ethnic tensions in Iraq and Syria appear to undermine efforts to defeat the Islamic State, as Laritza Hoke reports.
As Kurdish forces prepare a major offensive against Islamic State in Syria, hundreds of civilians are fleeing into Turkey. A Turkish official has accused the Kurds of driving out Arabs from the areas they capture. The United States supports Kurds in their fight against Islamic State, but is warning against sectarian violence. Meanwhile, members of the Druze minority in the Middle East have called on the international community to protect their brethren in Syria, where the al-Nusra Front recently killed 20 Druze villagers. Several groups fight Islamic State and al-Nusra Front in Syria, including government forces, but they also fight each other. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The International Criminal Court wants South Africa to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who is in Johannesburg for an African Union summit. The ICC says Mr. Bashir has two outstanding warrants. He has been charged with war crimes and genocide for sending the army in and backing Arab militias and putting down an armed uprising in the Darfur conflict in 2003. North Korea to date test fired 3 short-range missiles into the Sea of Japan just weeks after claiming a successful submarine-based ballistic missile test. South Korea's defense ministry says the North fired 3 KN-01 missiles from its eastern border town of Wonsan, which flew about 100 kilometers before landing in the sea. The test is the latest since Pyongyang's May 9th launch of 3 anti-ship cruise missiles. The chief of South Korea's Samsung Hospital told a televised news conference today the war hospital will suspend all non-emergency surgeries. Soon Tae-ho said the hospital will not accept any new patients either, since the deadly Middle East respiratory syndrome has taken a foothold in the facility. Since the first case was identified on May 20th, 145 people have been confirmed with the virus, 15 of which have died. Pakistan's Interior Ministry is allowing non-governmental organization Save the Children to resume operations after shutting down its headquarters in Islamabad last week and giving staff members 15 days to leave the country. The ministry did not elaborate on its reversal. Authorities sealed the office in the capital Thursday, accusing the organization of anti-Pakistan activities. By Friday, every office in the country had been closed. They said that they were suspicious of their activities. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Special human rights groups, of course, will be supportive of the call of Bashir's detention.
A South African court attempt to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir.
No place is safe, no place in the world, but we are taking all the measures, everything is controlled, and now it is a question of international solidarity against terrorism.
The Egyptian Prime Minister visits the ancient temple site in Luxor, recently targeted by a suicide bomber.
I'm even prouder to be here today to congratulate 27 extraordinary young Zimbabweans. You are an extraordinary group of people, and you follow in the proud tradition of many other extraordinary Zimbabweans.
I'm brilliant but needy Zimbabwean students win scholarships to study in the United States. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A South African judge on Sunday ordered authorities to prevent Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who is in South Africa for an African Union summit, from leaving the country. The International Criminal Court, or ICC, has issued two arrest warrants against Mr. Bashir after accusing him of human rights violations and crimes against humanity. For more on the court's ruling, I reached Dr. Somado Dafikeni, who is an independent policy analyst and chairman of the Walter Sisulu University Council in South Africa.
Well, it is unlikely, especially if the African heads of states would decide to give solidarity to Omar Bashir. South Africa would have very little choice but to let him go.
The issue, however, is that the ANC has said that the government should appeal the ruling because the government granted immunity to all heads of state, including President Bashir, in order for them to participate in this AU summit. Is this a competing diplomatic commitment, knowing that the South African government is a signatory to the ICC as well as a prominent member of the African Union?
Certainly, remember that the African Union heads of states had said that whilst negotiations and also some heads of states are still in office, they should not be tried, it should only be after. And they also indicated the bias there is against many of the African leaders. Of course, that's a debatable issue. That in itself would have been signaling a political stance by the African heads of state to say that the international bodies at times do not give them the same fair treatment as the others. And besides, you'll remember that EU countries had banned Mugabe from coming to the EU together with some of his officials. But the moment he assumed the position of the leadership of AU and the leadership of the Southern African countries currently, he then was, that particular ban was lifted for the duration of his term of office and also if he is attending official events on behalf of the African states. Similarly, the UN, when UN issue invitation to heads of states, it doesn't matter that the US may actually not be happy with some of them, as you have seen Castro and many others attending, because during that time you do have a diplomatic immunity.
Well, Dr. Fikeni, how are South Africans, especially human rights organizations, reacting to this diplomatic impasse?
Well, special human rights groups, of course, will be supportive of the call of Bashir's detention, but average South Africans really are not even very much attuned to these issues. They only know that there is a summit that is going on.
So far, what is your take on the stance taken by the African National Congress, the ruling party, about this issue on the court ruling over Bashir?
Well, I do think that they are well aware of the dilemma that, one, the rule of law, the government has to do something in terms of the courts having made a ruling. Therefore, the appeal is most likely the case when Monday comes, when businesses are open. But again, they are well aware of South Africa's leading role in the African continent and the sensitivity of South Africa, which would be seen to be at variance with other African leaders, and therefore not being a good host, so to speak.
Now, if the appeal is indeed carried out by the government, wouldn't that take a little bit of time, and that will allow possibly President Bashir to leave the country before even that is taken up?
Well, politically, in all possibility, I think President al-Bashir will leave the country. Government will do all the appeals and other things, but they are unlikely to detain him.
Dr. Somado Dafikeni is an independent policy analyst and chairman of the Walter Sisulu University Council in South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. Egyptian Prime Minister has visited the ancient temple site in Luxor, targeted by a suicide bomber. He said security forces are doing everything possible to keep tourists safe. Meanwhile, Muslim Brotherhood supporters have warned of a backlash if the death sentence against former President Mohamed Morsi is confirmed. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell has more.
Egyptian Prime Minister Ibrahim Mahlab went on a nighttime tour of all the major temple complexes in Luxor Thursday in an attempt to reassure tourists that Egypt's ancient sites are safe. He urged international solidarity to fight terrorism.
Sure that any place in the world is safe, 100%? No place is safe, 100%. Without really this kind of coalition and solidarity, no place is safe, no place in the world, but we are taking all the measures, everything is controlled, and now it is a question of international solidarity against terrorism.
Wednesday's attack targeted the 4,000-year-old Karnak Temple in Luxor. The bomber blew himself up before entering the complex. One gunman was shot and another captured. Four people, including two policemen, were wounded. Earlier this month, to the north, near Cairo, two police officers were shot dead on a road near the pyramids at Giza. The number of tourists visiting Egypt has fallen by at least a third since the 2011 Arab Spring, but had been slowly recovering in recent months. Despite the attack in Luxor, tourists have returned to the Karnak Temple in the days since. William Pace from the United States says he was not deterred.
We still came to Karnak because these sorts of things happen, and the police took care of it. Same things happen in the United States. It doesn't keep me from going to cities there. So, things happen. Violence happens around the world. You can't, be afraid.
Tourists have been targeted in the past. In 1997, suspected Islamist extremists killed 59 visitors, most of them foreigners, also in Luxor. In recent years, Islamist militants in the Sinai Peninsula, previously known as Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, have launched attacks on government targets. In early 2014, they claimed responsibility for an attack on a tourist bus in Sinai, in which three South Koreans and the Egyptian bus driver were killed. But in the year since, the militants' focus remained on government and security targets, even as they proclaimed their allegiance to the self-styled Islamic State. Tobias Bork of the Royal United Services Institute says the Luxor attack suggests their goals may be changing.
Speculations will be whether this means that the radicals are adopting new tactics, are taking a different approach, feeling that they're not quite getting to where they want to get by just attacking the security forces. An option is also that this is a different kind of group with a different kind of agenda.
The overthrow of former President Mohamed Morsi in 2013 was initially seen as a crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which the government frequently conflated with jihadists. Bork says this is fueling the Islamist insurgency.
The government of President Sisi is engaged in a massive crackdown on all forms of political dissent in Egypt at the moment. That does not mean that this is an attack carried out by the Muslim Brotherhood.
But tensions are rising among Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Former President Morsi was given a provisional death sentence last month for his role in a 2011 prison break. The final verdict is due June 16th. His supporters have warned of a huge backlash if the death sentence is confirmed. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Officials in Warab State say at least 18 people have been killed in clashes between two communities there in the last month. The clashes do not appear to be related to the broader conflict in South Sudan, but are still ongoing and causing tensions. For VOA, Philip Thorn Aliu has details from Juba.
Wolanai, Commissioner of Warab State's Gaurial East County, says 18 people have died and 20 injured in his county alone. And he says the fighting began in April, when a dispute flared between fishermen from Gaurial East and neighboring Gaurial West counties over a fishing site. He says that dispute was resolved, but fighting flared again around a month ago.
Started on 14th. Up to now, it is still continuing. Three old men were killed in cold blood, plus the five others. They were found playing cards in under Tukul. A lot of destruction of properties and displacement all together are continuing now.
Anai says officials from Gaurial East and West counties are working together to try to stop the fighting. He says more policemen and soldiers have been deployed to the two counties to ease tension and keep order. He says political and traditional leaders are meeting with youths from both communities to try to stop the hostilities. Anai says members of communities in the two counties are accusing each other of instigating the latest clashes.
But the realities will be established by investigation later on when the culprits are arrested and investigated, and then they are charged and investigated. Then the facts will be established from there. And I recommend the chief to be the first people to be investigated in this case.
And I say thousands of people have been displaced by the fighting, though he could not give a precise number. Gaurial West County Commissioner Makuich Aru did not return phone calls from South Sudan in Focus to try to confirm how many people were killed or injured in his community. A local newspaper report citing Warab State officials says 24 people have been killed in the violence in the two counties since April. There is no known motive for the recent attacks, although there could be revenge killings for the clash over the fishing site. Disputes between South Sudanese communities over grazing or water rights are common, and a perceived lack of justice for the victims of those disputes often results in armed civilians seeking revenge. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
The mobile car for hire service Uber has finally arrived in Kenya and is generating some buzz. But as Hilary Hula reports for VOA from the capital, Nairobi, local Kenyan competition is stiff, and not everyone thinks Uber knows what it is getting itself into.
When Franklin Sayalel first heard a new taxi company was setting up shop in Nairobi, where he runs a fashion business, he was more confused than excited.
At first, I didn't get it. I mean, I checked it out and it was like all these fancy cars. So I didn't get the concept. Was it like a company that has cars? Then later on I found out like there are people who actually like rent out their cars. I didn't get the whole concept.
The company was Uber, which launched in Nairobi in January. This isn't Uber's first foray into sub-Saharan Africa. It also operates in South Africa and Nigeria. But when the company landed in Kenya, it found it wasn't alone. There are at least three other mobile taxi hailing services in Nairobi, at least two of which maintain they're better suited to the local market. Marimoja uses social media to find taxi drivers your friends trust, claiming that personal recommendations carry the most weight with Kenyans. MyTaxi appeals to price-sensitive customers by having drivers bid for each ride. Some say a business dependent on GPS maps is problematic in a country where people usually navigate by landmarks, and complain that Uber drivers tend to get lost. Sayalel says he's had this problem with Easy Taxi, another Uber-like service from Brazil.
Most of them don't even know how to read the GPS. So you're actually waiting for your cab, and you're seeing on the, you know, on the app, the guy is just driving around in circles. He's not getting the location. And I've had experiences where I just cancel my trip.
But the biggest hurdle Uber has faced is probably payments. Until last week, the service only accepted credit or debit cards, despite the fact that only a small percentage of Kenyans use them. An estimated 4% in 2012, only a little higher now. Uber now accepts cash and mobile money payments. But Mwambu Wanindea of Uber Africa says they're still fighting the perception that Uber is an upscale product.
I don't think that people realize that the prices are in fact very, very competitive, and in many cases cheaper than the regular taxis. I think that's because people who use them have a smartphone. There's a perception that the rides are more expensive than they actually are.
Wanindea says his company's Nairobi customer base has been growing fast. But Mark Manyuru, one of the founders of MyTaxi, says that Uber still has a long way to go before it's embraced by the masses. His cost-cutting service, he says, is aimed at ordinary Kenyans.
We have Uber for people jetting in at JKIA. We have Uber for tourists. They love Uber. What happens to the common Kenyan? So the need is what we're trying to solve.
Kenya certainly isn't Uber's only competitive market. Its pockets are deep, and it's used to fighting for users. But Manyuru says he's not intimidated.
This particular market is different from the others Uber has taken over. Let's take a look at Singapore, for example. It has got structures. It has got a pre-existing taxi culture. The amount of convincing Uber has to do within this particular market basically makes them a startup too. There's no difference between us and them.
It can be hard for foreign companies to figure out what Kenyans want, notes Sayalel. It is possible to introduce such fancy ideas here, he says, but don't expect it to be easy. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
There was pomp and fanfare in the Zimbabwean capital Harare as 27 academically gifted students from economically disadvantaged families were awarded scholarships worth $6 million to study in the United States. This under the USA Education's United States Student Achievers Program, or USAP. For VOA, Ivan Chofera has more from Harare.
United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe Bruce Wharton congratulated the students, saying the USAP program, launched in 2000 when he was public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy, had made the U.S. and Zimbabwe proud.
I'm even prouder to be here today to congratulate 27 extraordinary young Zimbabweans. You are an extraordinary group of people, and you follow in the proud tradition of many other extraordinary Zimbabweans.
The students, who were accompanied by their parents and relatives, expressed their great joy in going to some of the best universities and colleges in the U.S. Alpha Ngwenya of Victoria Falls, who is headed for Arizona State University, said he will do his best in his studies.
When I go to the States, I want to study social work because I have a passion in me to change the society that I grew up in.
Malvin Madondo, who attended All Souls Mission and St. Francis of Assisi in Chivu.
I'm hoping to study mathematics and computer science in the light that Zimbabwe is a country that is developing, and in the near future need students who will be able to run the digital part of Zimbabwe. Is always the logical part. So I'm hoping to come back to Zimbabwe after I've done my studies so that I will contribute my country.
Sisasengo Simandi, who did a secondary education at Masiepambili College in Bulawayo and will study public health at Brown University, also promised to help local communities.
I think one of the core things that is USAP is giving back to your community. And our communities is where we've grown up. Zimbabwe is our home. And we are looking to gain things that will help us to come and give back.
Among those who got a scholarship was Congolese national Joel Shite, who grew up at Tongogara refugee camp in Chipinge, Manicaland province. Shite, who is going to study electrical engineering at the University of Southern Indiana, is excited that his refugee status did not deter him from achieving his dreams.
Refugee is just a word, but that does not define who we are. Now today I'm joining other great students in Zimbabwe who are also going to the United States. I didn't dream of it, so I really feel great.
Joel's father, Shite Chitindelax said he was very proud of his son's achievements.
Joel is number 5, and I'm very proud today. The way we stay in Tongogara, no one can believe that this can happen to one of the refugee boys. So it happened to me, so I'm proud and I'm thankful to my God.
The U.S. government has spent more than $50 million on USAP since its inception, and more than 300 Zimbabwean students have studied under the program, with most of them returning to Zimbabwe after completing their studies. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
A shopping mall constructed entirely out of shipping containers is nearing completion in Johannesburg, South Africa. The architectural design is called 27 Boxes because each box container is 27 square meters. It is for Africa and is modeled on similar projects in London, Paris and Christchurch. For VOA, Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
Construction workers add finishing touches to the 27 Boxes project in the creative Johannesburg suburb of Melville. Its creator is Satik Group structural engineer and architect Arthur Blake.
We had extremely limited funds. It continued to rain. As we went down, we got rock, which delayed the project. We've never done a retail development. This one took me by surprise at how long it would actually take.
Blake says he didn't want to build just another shopping mall, of which the city has plenty.
They've got no character, they just brick buildings.
He wanted to do something different at the site, something he'd never before attempted, to construct an affordable shopping space entirely from shipping containers. The recycled material is significantly cheaper to build with than conventional steel, brick and mortar. This project cost about $2.5 million, as opposed to $3.5 million for a traditional build. But from the outset, says Blake, there were plenty of skeptics.
People just said containers are shacks on steroids.
One of the doubters was Blake's colleague, project marketing manager Mandy Shave.
I thought shipping containers, running a mall within shipping containers, how's it going to work? How are they going to fit?
But Blake's vision of completing the development for Melville's dreamers and artists, as he calls his soon-to-be tenants, wouldn't die.
This unique opportunity just started developing in my mind that we could create a space for these guys. Simultaneously, we could develop the park into a very artisanal zone.
Shave says about 100 containers will be rented to people selling products you won't easily find at a mall packed with franchise stores. From craft beer to Philly cheesesteaks and wood-fired bread to handmade jewelry and clothing.
And we've done a very good job to make sure that we have a very good mix of people, that it's people who've got, you know, high-end, beautiful quality products, a strong focus on making sure it is artists, and then giving them an opportunity to open a store.
On average, the containers will cost about $400 a month to rent, much cheaper than stores in the big malls, which can easily cost 10 times more. This has made it possible for people like Sean Mulroe to be one of 27 Boxes' first tenants.
I'm going to be opening a nursery. I'm going to be mostly selling veggies and herbs and hopefully selling fresh herbs and veggies to the little restaurants that are opening as well, so we can all keep organic and fresh.
Shave says 27 Boxes, with its many open spaces, will be one of the most environmentally friendly shopping areas ever in South Africa.
The green aspect of using a shipping container is also what is attracting a lot of people to go, wow, this is so different. I didn't realize you could do this with a shipping container.
Blake says several internationally renowned architects have congratulated him on what he describes as his dream project. And 27 Boxes is set to open within a few weeks. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 14th. We have plenty of football news from the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifiers, the FIFA Under-20 World Cup, and the FIFA Women's World Cup. Let's start with the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, which kicked off across the continent on Friday. Here are the highlights of match day one. Nigeria made a winning start. Zimbabwe created an upset. South Africa and Zambia were held at home, while Cape Verde scored 7 goals and Angola 4 against weak rivals. Here in Nigeria, the Super Eagles beat Chad 2-0 in the northern city of Kaduna on Saturday. Bola Hansalami broke the deadlock on 63 minutes, and Odion Ighalo converted the penalty 10 minutes from time to complete a routine victory. A bonus controversy that delayed their departure from France and the late arrival of their luggage, including their kits, did not help the Chadians. In Blantyre, Zimbabwe, which missed a flight to Malawi and traveled by bus, scored a 2-1 victory. In Durban, the absence of Tokelo Ranti, who is on a honeymoon, left South Africa without a recognized striker, and the team paid the price as Gambia forced a goalless draw. In Undola, 2012 African champion Zambia was also held goalless at home by Guinea-Bissau. Also, Cape Verde, seeking a third consecutive Nations Cup appearance, showed why it is ranked 150 places above fellow island states Sao Tome and Principe with a 7-1 triumph in Praia. And Algeria, the top-ranked African team, scored twice in each half for a 4-0 win over visiting Seychelles. Let's now give a full rundown of the results of matches played on Friday and Saturday. Group A, Tunisia 8, Djibouti 1. Group B, Angola 4, Central African Republic 0. Group C, Mali 2, South Sudan 0. Group D, Uganda 2, Botswana 0. Burkina Faso 2, Comoros 0. Group E, Zambia 0, Guinea-Bissau 0. Group F, Morocco 1, Libya 0. Cape Verde 7, Sao Tome and Principe 1. Group G, Nigeria 2, Chad 0. Group J, Algeria 4, Seychelles 0. Group K, Senegal 3, Burundi 1. Group L, Guinea 1, Swaziland 2. Malawi 1, Zimbabwe 2. And Group M, South Africa 0, Gambia 0. As I reported last week, a total of 51 teams are participating in the qualifiers. The teams are divided into 13 groups of 4 teams each, with the exception of one group that has only 3 teams. At the end of the qualifiers, all the group winners, plus the 2 runners-up among 4 team groups with the best records, will qualify. The 15 countries will join host Gabon in the 16-team final. In more football news, Africa has won 2 semi-final places at the ongoing FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand. In their quarter-final matches today, Sunday, Mali and Senegal, which managed to advance from the group stage, kept up their surprising run in the tournament. Mali pulled off its biggest upset yet by beating European champion Germany 4-3 on penalties. Both teams played 1-1 in regulation time. Mali coach Faneri Diarra dedicated the win to the supporting public in Mali. For its part, Senegal beats Uzbekistan 1-0 for the only regulation time win in Sunday's quarterfinals
three of which were decided by shootouts. Mamadou Thiam scored in the 76th minute to send first-time qualifier Senegal to the last four. Two other African teams, former world champion Ghana and African champion Nigeria, could not make it beyond the round of 16. Ghana was defeated by fellow West African team Mali, while Nigeria lost to Germany. Talking of Nigeria, what happened to the Flying Eagles of Nigeria in their match against Germany? That was the question I put to Sam Audu, the media officer for the Nigerian team.
We lost the game, especially the fact that we didn't start early, we didn't start well. The Germans capitalized on our slow start and could have even won the game hands down by the first half. Second half, we chased the game and they were just too professional and too tactical for us. And then we were out, we were going to go home. We wanted to be the last team to go back home from New Zealand, but we are going home early.
Since reaching the quarterfinals of the tournament in 2011, Nigeria has not advanced beyond the round of 16 in subsequent tournaments, including the ongoing one in New Zealand. Is this an indication that the standard of play of our national under-20 team, the Flying Eagles, is going down?
You can't take it like that. I think that we have to really do some investigations, find out what really is the problem, you know, because really we've done well in under-17, but then when it comes to under-20, we seem to struggle. We've qualified for the last 10 under-20 tournaments, so to speak, but we've not gone beyond the quarterfinals. So it's something to worry about, and I think it's something that we need to look at, you know, critically.
Now that the team is out of the ongoing tournament in New Zealand, what's next?
Well, it's down to the NFF to decide on what's next to do with the team. But I know a lot of these players, most of them will go to the Olympic team, which is still in training camp. They have the All-Africa game. They also have the qualifiers for the Olympics. So most of those boys, I want to believe, will be drafted to do under-23 team.
That was Sam Audu, the media officer for the Flying Eagles of Nigeria. He spoke with me on telephone from New Zealand. Meanwhile, in the semi-finals on Wednesday, Brazil will take on Senegal, while Serbia will meet Mali. Turning to the FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada, the three African teams face the prospect of an early elimination unless they can raise the tempo of their game. While Cameroon and Nigeria have a fairly good chance of advancing from the group stage, Ivory Coast faces an uphill task. The Ivorians have lost their two matches so far and are glued to the bottom of Group D without a point. A victory against Norway in their final group match on Monday may not make any difference. For its part, Cameroon has won one match and lost one, and is third in Group C on 3 points. A victory against Switzerland in their final group match on Tuesday will see Cameroon moving on to the round of 16. And Nigeria also stands a chance to reach the round of 16 if it can beat the United States by more than 2 goals in their final group game on Tuesday. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now, sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Yeah.
Change my name to Godwin. I no more. I don't buy more to Godwin. They say my market no go sell for Godwin. And then we say I no go blue for Godwin. Them my brother, make them try their luck. My God to win, oh my God to win, oh my Lord to win, oh. Don't pass exam, now God you win. And then we say you no go pass, for God you win. You wake up, see two day last song, now God you win. Robbers, they rob, they no see you, brother. God you win. They no see you, my sister. Oh, yeah, better pass.
God you win,
now
God you win, now God you win.
Now your wedding day, now God you win. And you don't say where you be fine, but God you win. See we go pop champagne today, God you win. Oh, we go day dancing, dancing, dance, cause God you win. Oh, lelele, anything you win, now God you win. And if you win election, my brother, God you win. Like if you win the contract, my friend, now God you win.
And if you check the countdown, we're going to have God the wind. And if your market sell, le, now God the wind, oh, now God the wind, oh, now God the wind, oh.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In April this year, students at the prestigious South African University, University of Cape Town, staged demonstrations calling for the removal of the statue of Cecil Rhodes, the founder of the university. Cecil Rhodes was a British businessman and a mining magnate. In his time, he was regarded as the wealthiest man in the world. However, to the South African students, he is the embodiment of all that is unworthy of the British Empire and British imperialism. Even though many students in the English-speaking world have benefited from the Rhodes Scholarship, which permitted them to study at Oxford University in England. But Cecil Rhodes was also a man of grand vision. He conceived the idea of a railroad from Cape of South Africa to Cairo, the famous Cape to Cairo Railroad. Unfortunately, this never materialized in his lifetime. Now there are modern African economists who have been working on the plan to create a free trade zone extending from South Africa to Cairo in Egypt. Negotiations have just concluded last week to form the tripartite free trade zone. And this comprises merging three existing economic zones, including SADC and COMESA, with Egypt a member of COMESA. There will be over 26 countries as members of this free trade zone of Eastern and Central Africa. At this stage, the West African Economic Community of ECOWAS is not included. There are optimists who believe that this new endeavor will boost African trade. It has long been the dream to promote intra-African trade. Some economists have even suggested that some increase in intra-African trade of few percentage will obviate the need for ODA, official direct assistance. There is also the possibility that this venture might succeed because of the old British colonial policy, in which so-called settler countries, that is, without mosquitoes, have better infrastructure. And where there is a gap, the Chinese government has moved in to create better infrastructure. For example, China is modernizing the narrow gauge of the Kenyan Railway and linking it with all of its neighbors. When completed, this infrastructure will help the new tripartite trade area. There is also the possibility that this new trade area might present a forum whereby Egypt and the Libyan state of the Nile will be able to resolve their disputes over the use of the Nile River. So we have to hope and pray that these new modern African economists who have set out on this vision will be able to succeed where Cecil Rhodes failed. The agreement itself will be presented or tabled at the current AU summit meeting taking place in Johannesburg. Once it has received the blessing of the AU, every member state, the 26 states, will have to ratify the agreements, and then it may come into force in 2017. Let's hope that this materializes. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline African team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulia, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot convince a monkey that honey is sweeter than a banana. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against ISIL will be long, but if the coalition remains united, determined, and focused, it will ultimately succeed, said U.S. Undersecretary of State Antony Blinken. Some gains have been achieved in the last 9 months since the coalition has come together. ISIL now controls 25% less territory in Iraq than it did when the fighting first started, and ISIL has lost significant numbers of men and materiel. At the same time, the coalition partners acknowledge that ISIL remains resilient, ruthless, and capable of taking the initiative, as they did in the capture of Ramadi. "We have to learn from and act on such setbacks," said Undersecretary Blinken. "In Iraq right now, we have the right strategy, a combination of coalition airstrikes, training, equipping, assisting, and effective local partners." As for Iraq's part, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider Abadi has laid out an effective military and political action plan for his country. It calls for accelerating the training and equipping of local tribes in coordination with Anbar authorities, streamlining the provision of weapons, expanding recruitment into the Iraqi army, recalling and refitting the local police, supporting a development fund for stabilization to get immediate assistance to areas that are cleared of ISIL, and ensuring that all forces in Iraq act under Iraqi command, a critical element of the plan to ensure accountability and a unified approach in the fight against ISIL. One immediate step that the U.S. is taking is to ship anti-tank rockets for use against the kind of suicide vehicles that were deployed in Ramadi to such terrible effect. Also, the U.S. is doing all it can to aid the region's millions of refugees and displaced persons from both Syria and Iraq. The United States has provided $3.7 billion in humanitarian aid to those affected by the war in Syria. And since the start of fiscal year 2014, more than $407 million for displaced Iraqis. The U.S. and its coalition partners remain determined to defeat ISIL, ultimately creating a future of opportunity and peace for people in Iraq, in Syria, and indeed in the entire region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.